Chapter 22.
A week has passed. We're grouped around a computer terminal in the conference room. Ralph has extracted from the computer a list of overdue orders that we shipped last week.
There you have it.
Not bad.
Not bad? It's a lot better than not bad.
We must be doing something right.
Yeah, but it isn't enough.
Isn't enough? At least it's progress. We shipped 12 orders last week. For this plant, that's not bad. And they were our 12 most overdue orders.
By the way, our worst overdue order is now only 44 days late. As you may recall, the worst one used to be 58 days.
All right.
Their enthusiasm is somewhat justified. The new system of tagging all the batches according to priority and routing has been working fairly well. The bottlenecks are getting their parts promptly. In fact, the piles of inventory in front of them have grown. Following bottleneck processing, the red-tagged parts have been getting to final assembly faster. It's as if we've created an express lane through the plant for bottleneck parts. After putting QC in front of the bottlenecks, we discovered that about 5% of the parts going into the NCX-10 and about 7% going into heat treat did not conform to quality requirements. If those percentages hold true in the future, we'll effectively have gained that time for additional throughput. The new policy of having people cover the bottlenecks on lunch breaks has also gone into effect. We're not sure how much we've gained from that, because we didn't know how much we were losing before. At least we're doing the right thing now. But I have heard reports from time to time the NCX-10 is idle, and it happens when there's nobody on break. Donovan is supposed to be looking into the causes. The combination of these has allowed us to ship our most critical orders and to ship a few more of them than normal. But I know we're not going fast enough. A few weeks ago, we were limping along. Now we're walking, but we ought to be jogging. Glancing back toward the data terminal, I see the eyes are upon me. Listen, I know we've taken a step in the right direction, but we have to accelerate the progress. It's good that we got 12 shipments out last week, but we're still having some customer orders become past due. It's not as many, I'll grant you, but we still have to do better. We really shouldn't have any late orders. Everyone walks away from the terminal and joins me around the table. Bob Donovan starts telling me how they're planning some refinements on what we've already done. Bob, those are fine, but they're minor. How are we coming on the other suggestions Jonah made?
Well, we're looking into them.
I want recommendations on offloading the bottlenecks ready for our Wednesday staff meeting.
Okay.
You'll have them for us?
Whatever it takes.
That afternoon in my office, I have a meeting with Elroy Langston, our QC manager, and Barbara Penn, who handles employee communications. Barbara writes the newsletters, which are now explaining the background and reasons for the changes taking place in the plant. Last week, we distributed the first issue. I put her together with Langston to have her work on a new project. After parts exit the bottlenecks, they often tend to look almost identical to the parts going into the bottlenecks. Only a close examination by a trained eye will detect the difference in some cases. The problem is how to make it easy for the employee to tell the two apart and to make it possible for the employee to treat the post-bottleneck parts so more of them make it to assembly and are shipped as quality products. Langston and Penn are in my office to talk about what they've come up with.
We already have the red tags, so that tells us the part is on a bottleneck routing. What we need is a simple way to show people the parts they need to treat with special attention, the ones they need to treat like gold.
That's a suitable comparison.
So what if we simply mark the tags with pieces of yellow tape after the parts are finished by the bottlenecks? The tape would tell people on site that these are the parts you treat like gold. In conjunction with this, I'll do an internal promotion to spread the word about what the tape means. For media, we might use some sort of bulletin board poster, an announcement that the foreman would read to the hourly people, maybe a banner which would hang in the plant, those kinds of things.
As long as the tape can be added without slowing down the bottlenecks, that sounds fine.
I'm sure we can find a way to do it so it doesn't interfere.
Good. One other concern of mine is that I don't want this to be just a lot of promotion.
That's perfectly understood. Right now, we're systematically identifying the causes of quality problems on the bottlenecks and in subsequent processing. Once we know where to aim, we'll be having specific procedures developed for bottleneck-routed parts and processes. And once they're established, we'll be setting up training sessions so people can learn those procedures. But that's obviously going to take some time. For the short term, we're specifying that the existing procedures be double-checked for accuracy on the bottleneck routes.
We talked that over for a few minutes, but basically all of it seemed sound to me. I tell them to proceed full speed and to keep me informed of what's happening. Nice job. By the way, Roy, I thought Bob Donovan was going to sit in on this meeting.
That man is hard to catch these days, but I'll brief him on what we talked about.
Just then, the phone rings. Reaching with one hand to answer it, I wave to Langston and Penn with the other as they walk out the door.
Al, hi, this is Donovan.
It's too late to call in sick. Don't you know you just missed a meeting?
Al, have I got something to show you? You got time to take a little walk?
Yeah, I guess so. What's this all about?
Well, I'll tell you when you get here. Meet me on the receiving dock.
I walk down to the dock where I see Bob. He's standing there waving to me as if I might miss him, which would be impossible. There is a flatbed truck backed up to the dock, and in the middle of the bed is a large object on a skid. The object is covered by a gray canvas tarp, which has ropes tying it down. A couple of guys are working with an overhead crane to move the thing off of the truck. They're raising it into the air as I walk up to Bob. He cups his hands around his mouth.
Easy there!
He watches the big gray thing sway back and forth. Slowly, the crane maneuvers the cargo back from the truck and lowers it safely to the concrete floor. The workers release the hoist chains. Bob walks over and has them untie the ropes holding down the canvas.
We'll have it off in a minute.
I stand there patiently, but Bob can't refrain from helping. When all the ropes are untied, Donovan takes hold of the tarp and, with a flare of gusto, flings it off of what it's concealing.
Ta-da!
He stands back and gestures to what has to be one of the oldest pieces of equipment I've ever seen.
What the hell is that?
It's a smegma.
He takes a rag and wipes off some of the grime.
They don't build them like this anymore.
I'm very glad to hear that.
Al, the smegma is just the machine we need.
It looks like it might have been state-of-the-art for 1942. How's it going to help us?
Well, I admit it ain't no match for the NCX-10. But if you take this baby right here and one of those screwmeisters over there and that other machine off in the corner, together they can do all the things the NCX-10 can do.
I glance around at the different machines. All of them are old and idle. I step closer to the smegma to look it over.
So this must be one of the machines you told Jonah we sold to make way for the inventory holding pen.
You got it.
It's practically an antique. All of them are. Are you sure they can give us acceptable quality?
It is an automated equipment, so with human error we might make a few more mistakes. But if you want capacity, this is the quick way to get it.
It's looking better and better. Where did you find this thing?
Called a buddy of mine this morning up at our South End plant. He told me he still had a couple of these sitting around, and he'd have no problem parting with one of them. So I grabbed a guy from maintenance, and we took a ride up to have a look.
What did it cost us?
The rental fee on the truck to haul it down. The guy at South End told us just to go ahead and take it. He'll write it off a scrap. With all of the paperwork he'd have to do, it was too much trouble to sell it to us.
Does it still work?
It did before we left. Hey, let's find out.
The maintenance man connects the power cable to an outlet on a nearby steel column. Bob reaches for the power switch and hits the on button. For a second, nothing happens. Then we hear the slow gathering whir from somewhere in the guts of the old machine. Poofs of dust blow out of the antique fan housing. Bob turns to me with a dumb grin on his big face.
Guess we're in business.
Chapter 23.
Rain is beating at the windows of my office. Outside, the world is gray and blurred. It's the middle of a middle-of-the-week morning. In front of me are some so-called productivity bulletins put out by Hilton Smythe, which I've come across in my in-basket. I haven't been able to make myself read past the first paragraph of the one on top. Instead, I'm gazing at the rain and pondering the situation with my wife. Julie and I went out on our date that Saturday night, and we actually had a good time. It was nothing exotic. We went to a movie, we got a bite to eat afterwards, and for the heck of it, we took a drive through the park on the way home. Very tame, but it was exactly what we needed. It was good just to relax with her. I admit that at first I felt kind of like we were back in high school or something, but after a while, I decided that wasn't such a bad feeling. I brought her back to her parents at 2 a.m, and we made out in the driveway until her old man turned on the porch light. Since that night, we've continued to see each other. A couple of times last week, I made the drive up to see her. Once, we met halfway at a restaurant. I've been dragging myself to work in the morning, but with no complaints. We've had fun together. By some unspoken agreement, neither of us talk about divorce or marriage. The subject has only come up once, which happened when we talked about the kids and agreed they should stay with Julie and her folks as soon as school ends. I tried then to push us into some answers, but the old argument syndrome began to brew quickly, and I backed off to preserve the peace. It's a strange state of limbo we're in. It almost feels the way it did before we got married and settled down, only now we're both quite familiar to each other. And there is the storm, which has gone south for a while, but which is sure to swing back someday. A soft tap at the door interrupts this meditation. I see Fran's face peeking around the edge of the door.
Ted Spencer's outside. He says he needs to talk to you about something.
What about? Fran steps into the office and closes the door behind her. She quickly comes over to my desk and whispers to me.
I don't know, but I heard on the grapevine that he had an argument with Ralph Nakamura about an hour ago.
Okay, thanks for the warning. Send him in. A moment later, Ted Spencer comes in. He looks mad. I ask him what's happening down in Heat Tree.
Al, you gotta get that computer guy off my back.
You mean Ralph? What have you got against him?
He's trying to turn me into some kind of clerk or something. He's been coming around and asking all kinds of dumb questions. Now he wants me to keep some kind of special records on what happens in Heat Tree.
What kind of records?
I don't know. He wants me to keep a detailed log of everything that goes in and out of the furnaces. The times we put them in, the times we take them out, and how much time between heats, all that stuff. And I got too much to do to be bothered with all that. And in addition to Heat Treat, I got three other work centers I'm responsible for.
Why does he want this time log?
How should I know? I mean, we already got enough paperwork to satisfy anybody, as far as I'm concerned. I think Ralph just wants to play games with numbers. If he's got the time for it, then fine. Let him do it in his own department. I got the productivity in my department to worry about.
Okay, all right. I hear you. Let me look into it.
Will you keep him out of my area?
I'll let you know, Ted. After he's gone, I have Fran track down Ralph Nakamura for me. What's puzzling me is that Ralph is not what you'd call an abrasive person, and yet he sure seems to have made Ted very upset.
You wanted to see me?
Yeah, come on in and sit down. So, tell me what you did to light Ted Spencer's fuse.
All I wanted from him was to keep an accurate record of the actual times for each heat of parts in the furnace. I thought it was a simple enough request.
What prompted you to ask him?
I had a couple of reasons. One of them is that the data we have on Heat Treat seems to be very inaccurate. And if what you say is true, that this operation is so vital to the plant, then it seems to me we ought to have valid statistics on it.
What makes you think our data is so inaccurate?
Because after I saw the total on last week's shipments, I was kind of bothered by something. A few days ago on my own, I did some projections of how many shipments we would actually be able to make last week based on the output of parts from the bottlenecks. According to those projections, we should have been able to do about 18 to 20 shipments instead of 12. The projections were so far off that I figured at first I must have made a big mistake. So I took a closer look, double-checked my math. I couldn't find anything wrong. Then I saw that the estimates for the NCX-10 were within the ballpark. But for Heat Treat, there was a big difference.
And that's what made you think that the database must be in error.
Right. So I went down to talk to Spencer, and...
What?
Well, I noticed some funny things were happening. He was kind of tight-lipped when I started asking him questions. Finally, I just happened to ask him when the parts that were being treated in the furnace at the moment were going to be finished. I thought I'd get a time on an actual heat by myself, just to see if we were close to the standard. He said the parts could come out at around 3 p.m., so I went away and came back at 3, but nobody was around. I waited for about 10 minutes, then went to look for Ted. When I found him, he said he had the furnace helpers working somewhere else, and they'd get around to unloading the furnace in a little while. Oh, I didn't think much about it. Then around 5:30, as I was leaving for the day, I decided to go by the furnace to ask what time the parts had actually come out. But the same parts were still in there.
2.5 hours after they could have come out? They hadn't been unloaded?
That's right. So I found Sammy, the second shift foreman down there, and asked him what was going on. He told me he was shorthanded that night, and they'd get to it later. He said it didn't hurt the parts to stay in the furnace. While I was there, he shut off the burners, but I found out later that the parts didn't come out until about 8 o'clock. I didn't mean to start trouble, but I thought if we recorded the actual times per heat, we'd at least have some realistic figures to use for estimating. You see, I asked some of the hourly people down there, and they told me those kinds of delays happen a lot in Heat Treat.
No kidding. Ralph, I want you to take all the measurements down there that you need. Don't worry about Ted. And do the same thing on the NCX-10.
Well, I'd like to, but it's kind of a chore. That's why I wanted Ted and the others just to jot down the times and all.
Okay. We'll take care of that. And, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
By the way, what was the other reason
You mentioned you had more than one.
Well, it's probably not that important.
Nah, tell me.
Well, I don't really know if we can do it or not. But it occurred to me we might find a way to use the bottlenecks to predict when we'll be able to ship an order.
Bob Donovan's ears are on fire by the time I finish telling him what Ralph discovered about heat treat on his own. I'm very upset about this. He's sitting in a chair in my office while I walk circles in front of him. Finally, I'm done.
Al, the trouble is, there's nothing for the guys down there to do while heat treat's cooking the parts. You load up one of the damn furnaces, you shut the doors, and that's it for 6 or 8 hours, or however long it takes. What are they supposed to do? Stand around and twiddle their thumbs?
I don't care what they do between times, as long as they get the parts in and out of the furnace pronto. We could have done almost another batch of parts in the 5 hours of waiting for people to finish what they were doing elsewhere and change loads.
All right. How about this? We loan the people to other areas while the parts cook, but as soon as the time's up, we make sure we call them back immediately so they can...
No, because what's going to happen is everybody will be very conscientious about it for 2 days, and then it'll slip back to the way it is now. I want people at those furnaces, standing by, ready to load and unload 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The first ones I want assigned there are foremen, who are responsible full-time for what happens down there. And tell Ted Spencer that the next time I see him, he'd better know what's going on in heat treat or I'll kick his ass.
You bet. But, you know, you're talking about 2, maybe 3 people per shift?
Is that all? Don't you remember what lost time on a bottleneck costs us?
Okay, I'm with you. Tell you the truth, what Ralph found out about heat treat is a lot like what I found out on my own about those rumors of idle time on the NCX-10.
What's going on there?
Well, it's true the NCX-10 is sitting idle for as much as half an hour or more at a time, but the problem is not lunch breaks. If the NCX-10 is being set up and lunchtime rolls around, the 2 guys stay until the setup is completed. Or if the setup's a long one, they spell each other. You know, one goes and eats while the other continues with the setup. We're covered fine during the breaks. But if the machine stops, say, in the middle of the afternoon, it may sit there for 20, 30, 40 minutes or so before anyone gets around to starting a new setup. The reason is the setup people are busy with other machines, with non-bottlenecks.
Then let's do the same thing on the NCX-10 as I want to do on heat treat. Let's get a machinist and a helper and have them permanently stationed at the NCX-10. When it stops, they can get to work on it immediately.
That's just dandy with me. But you know how it's going to look on paper. It's going to seem like we increased the direct labor content of the parts coming out of heat treat and the NCX-10.
I slump into the chair behind my desk. Let's fight one battle at a time. The next morning, Bob comes to the staff meeting with his recommendations. They basically consist of 4 actions. The first 2 concern what he and I talked about the day before, dedicating a machinist and a helper to the NCX-10 and stationing a foreman and 2 workers at the heat treat furnaces. The assignments would apply to all 3 shifts. The other 2 recommendations concern offloading the bottlenecks. Bob has determined if we could activate 1 each of these old machines, the Smegma and the 2 others, just 1 shift a day, we could add 18% to the output of parts of the type produced by the NCX-10. Last of all is that we take some of the parts queued at heat treat and send them out to the vendor across town. As he's presenting these, I'm wondering what Lou is going to say. As it happens, Lou offers little resistance.
Knowing what we know now, it's perfectly legitimate for us to assign people to the bottlenecks if it will increase our throughput. We can certainly justify the cost if it increases sales and thereby increases cash flow. My question is, where are you going to get the people?
Well, we could call them back from layoff.
No, you can't. See, the problem we have is that the division has a recall freeze in effect. We can't recall without their approval.
Do we have people in the plant who can do these jobs?
You mean steal people from other areas?
Sure. Take people from the non-bottlenecks. By definition, they have excess capacity anyway.
Well, finding helpers for heat treat's no big deal. We got some old machinists who haven't been laid off because of seniority. They're qualified to run this Smegma and the other 2 machines. But establishing a 2-person setup crew on the NCX-10, that has me worried. And who's going to set up the other machines?
The helpers on the other machines know enough to set up their own equipment.
Well, I guess we can try it. But what happens if stealing people turns non-bottlenecks into bottlenecks?
The important thing is to maintain the flow. If we take a worker away and we can't maintain the flow, then we'll put the worker back and steal a body from someplace else. And if we still can't keep the flow going, then we'll have no choice but to go to division and insist that we either go to overtime or call a few people back from layoff.
Okay, I'll go for it.
I agree.
Good. Let's do it. And, Bob, make sure the people you pick are good. From now on, we put only our best people to work on the bottlenecks. And so it is done. The NCX-10 gets a dedicated setup crew. The Zmegma and the other machines go to work. The outfit across town is only too glad to take our surplus parts for heat treating. And in our own heat treat department, two people per shift are assigned to stand by, ready to load and unload parts from the furnaces. Donovan juggles the work center responsibilities, so heat treat has a foreman there at all times. For a foreman, heat treat seems like a very small kingdom, not much of a prize. There's nothing intrinsically attractive about running that operation, and having only two people to manage makes it seem like no big deal. To prevent it from seeming like a demotion to them, I make a point to go down there periodically on each of the shifts. In talking to the foreman, I drop some rather direct hints that the rewards will be great for anyone who can improve the output of heat-treated parts. Shortly thereafter, some amazing things happen. Very early one morning, I'm down there at the end of third shift. A young guy named Mike Haley is the foreman. He's a big black man whose arms always look as though they're going to burst the sleeves on his shirts. We've noticed that over the past week, he's pushed about 10% more parts through heat treat on his shift than the others have. Records are not usually set on the third shift, and we're starting to wonder if it's Mike's biceps that are doing the trick. Anyway, I go down there to try to learn what he's doing. As I walk up, I see the two helpers are not just standing around with nothing to do. They're moving parts. In front of the furnaces are two tightly organized stacks of work in process, which the helpers are building. I call Mike over and ask him what they're doing.
They're getting ready.
What do you mean?
They're getting ready for when we have to load one of the furnaces again. The parts in each stack are all treated at the same temperature.
So you're splitting and overlapping some batches?
Sure. I know we're not really supposed to do that, but you need the parts, right?
Yeah, sure, no problem. You're still doing the treating according to the priority system.
Oh, yeah. Come here, let me show you.
Mike leads me past the control console for the furnaces to a worn old battleship of a desk. He finds the computer printout for the week's most important overdue orders.
See? Look at number 22. We need 50 of the high-stress RB-11s. They get treated at a 1,200-degree temperature cycle. But 50 of them won't fill up the furnace. So we look down, and what do we see here but item number 31, which calls for 300 fitted retaining rings. Those also take a 1,200-degree cycle.
So you'll fill up the furnace with as many of the retaining rings after you've loaded the 50 of the first item.
Yeah, that's it. Only we do the sorting and stacking in advance so we can load the furnace faster.
That's good thinking.
Well, we could do even better if I could get someone to listen to an idea I got.
What do you have in mind?
Well, right now it takes anywhere up to an hour or so to change a furnace load using the crane or doing it by hand. Cut that down to a couple of minutes if we had a better system. Look at the furnaces. Each one of those has a table which the parts sit on. They slide in and out on rollers. If we could get some steel plate and maybe a little help from engineering, we could make those tables interchangeable. That way we could stack a load of parts in advance and switch loads with the use of a forklift. It saves us a couple of hours a day. That means we could do an extra heat of parts over the course of a week.
Mike, I want you to take tomorrow night off. We'll get one of the other foremen to cover for you.
Sounds good to me. How come?
Because the day after tomorrow, I want you on day turn. I'm going to have Bob Donovan put you together with an IE to write up these procedures formally so we can start using them round the clock. You keep that mind of yours working. We need it. Later that morning, Donovan happens by my office.
Hi there.
Well, hello. Did you get my note on Haley?
Yeah, it's being taken care of.
Good. And let's make sure he gets some more money out of this whenever the wage freeze is lifted.
Okay.
Something else?
Well, got good news for you.
How good?
You remember when Jonah asked us if all the parts going through heat treat really needed it?
I remember.
I just found out that in three cases, it wasn't engineering that specified heat treat, it was us.
What do you mean?
Well, about 5 years ago, some group of hotshots were trying to improve the efficiencies of several of the machining centers. To speed up the processing, the cutting tool bite was increased. So, on each pass, instead of shaving a chip that was a millimeter thick, the tool took off 3 millimeters. but increasing the amount of metal taken off on each pass made the metal brittle, and this necessitated heat treating. Thing is, the machines we made more efficient happened to be non-bottlenecks. We got enough capacity on them to slow down and still meet demand. And if we go back to the slower processing, we don't need the heat treat, which means we can take about 20% of the current load off the furnaces.
Sounds fantastic. What about getting it approved by engineering?
Hey, that's the beauty of it. We were the ones who initiated the change 5 years ago.
So if it was our option to begin with, we can change it back anytime we want.
Right. We don't need to get an engineering change order because we already have an approved procedure on the books.
He leaves shortly with my blessing to implement the change as soon as possible. I sit there marveling that we're going to reduce the efficiency of some operations and make the entire plant more productive. They'd never believe it on the 15th floor.
Chapter 24.
It's a Friday afternoon. Out in the parking lot, the people on first shift are getting into their cars to go home. There's the usual congestion at the gate. I'm in my office, minding my own business, when suddenly, from through the half-open door, something ricochets off the ceiling tiles. I jump to my feet, check myself for wounds, and, finding none, search the carpet for the offending missile. It's a champagne cork. There's laughing outside my door. In the next instant, it seems as though everyone is in my office. There's Stacy, Bob Donovan, who holds the bottle from which the cork came, Ralph, Fran, a couple of the secretaries, and a swarm of other people. Even Lou joins us. Fran hands me one of the styrofoam coffee cups she's dispensing to everyone. Bob fills it from the bottle. What's this all about?
Hey, I'll tell you in the toast I'm going to make as soon as everyone has something to swallow.
More bottles are opened. There's a case of this stuff. And when all the cups are filled, Bob lifts his own.
Okay. Here's to a new plant record in shipments of product. Lou went through the records for us and discovered that until now, the best this place has ever done in a month was 31 orders shipped at a value of about $2 million. This month, we topped that. We shipped 57 customer orders with a value of, well, in round numbers, we'll call it a cool $3
million. Yes. Not only did we ship more product, but having just calculated our inventory levels, I am pleased to report that between last month and now, we've had a 12% net decline in work-in-process inventory.
All right.
Well then, let's drink to making money.
Hey.
And we do.
Industrial strength champagne.
Very distinctive. Did you pick this out yourself?
Hey, keep drinking. It gets better.
I'm just about to hazard a second cup when I notice Fran beside me.
Mr. Rogo.
Yeah.
Bill Peach is on the line.
I shake my head, wondering what the hell it's going to be this time. I'll take it at your desk, Fran.
Okay.
I go out there and punch the blinking button on my phone and pick it up.
Yeah, Bill, what can I do for you?
I was just talking to Johnny Johns.
I automatically grab a pencil and pull over a pad of paper to take down the particulars on whatever order is causing us grief. I wait for Peach to continue, but he doesn't say anything for a second. What's the problem?
No problem, actually. He was very happy.
Really? What about?
He mentioned you've been coming through for him lately on a lot of late customer orders. Some kind of special effort, I guess.
Well, yes and no. We're doing a few things a little differently now.
Well, whatever. The reason I called is I know how I'm always on your case when things go wrong, Al, so I just wanted to tell you thanks for me and John's for doing something right.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. You are a truly wonderful person for driving me home, and I meant that truly.
Don't mention it. I'm glad we had something to celebrate.
She shuts off the engine. I look up at my house, which is dark, except for one light. I had the good sense earlier to call my mother and tell her not to hold dinner for me. That was smart, because the celebration continued onward and outward after Peach's call. About half of the original group went to dinner together. Lou and Ralph threw in the towel early. But Donovan, Stacy, and I, along with three or four diehards, went to a bar after we ate and we had a good time. Now it's 1:30 and I am blissfully stinko. The Buick, for safety's sake, is still parked behind the bar. Stacy, who switched to club soda a couple of hours ago, has generously played chauffeur to Bob and me. About 10 minutes ago, we nudged Donovan through his kitchen door, where he stood there bewildered for a moment before bidding us a good evening. If he remembers, Donovan is supposed to enlist his wife later today to drive us over to the bar and retrieve our vehicles. Stacy gets out of the car and comes around and opens my door so I can spill myself onto the driveway. Standing up on uncertain legs, I steady myself against the car.
I've never seen you smile so much.
I've got a lot to smile about.
Wish you could be this happy in staff meetings.
Henceforth, I shall smile continuously through all staff meetings.
Mm-hmm. Come on. I'll make sure you get to the door.
With her hands around my arm to steady me, she guides me up the front walk to the door. How about some coffee?
No, thanks. It's late and I better get home.
Sure?
Absolutely.
I fumble with the keys, find the lock, and the door swings open to a dark living room. I turn to Stacy and extend my hand. Thank you for a wonderful evening. I really had a swell time. Then, as we're shaking hands, I, for some reason, step backwards, trip over the doorstep, and lose all my balance.
Whoa!
The next thing I know, Stacy and I are sprawled on the floor together. Fortunately, or maybe not, as it turns out, Stacy thinks this is colossally funny. She's laughing so hard, tears start to roll down her cheeks, and so I start laughing too. Both of us are rolling on the floor with laughter when the lights come on.
You bastard!
I look up, my eyes adjusting to the sudden light, and there she is. Julie, what are you doing here? Without answering, she is now stomping through the kitchen. As I get to my feet and stagger after her, the door to the garage opens. The light switch in the garage clicks. I see her in silhouette for half a second.
Julie, wait a minute!
I hear the garage door rumbling open as I attempt to follow her. I go into the garage. She's already getting into her car. The door slams. I zigzag closer, wildly waving my arms. The engine starts.
I sit here waiting for you all night, putting up with your mother for 6 hours, and you come home drunk with some floozy!
But Stacy isn't a floozy. She's...
Accelerating to about 30 miles per hour in reverse, Julie backs out of the garage, down the driveway, narrowly missing Stacy's car, and into the street. I'm left standing there in the light of the garage. The tires of her car chirp upon the asphalt. She's gone. On Saturday morning, I wake up and groan a couple of times. The first groan is from the hangover. The second groan is from the memory of what happened. When I'm able, I get dressed and venture into the kitchen in quest of coffee. My mother is there.
You know your wife was here last night.
I pour my first cup. Then I find out what happened. Julie showed up just after I called here last night. She had driven over on impulse because she'd missed me and she'd wanted to see the kids. She apparently wanted to surprise me, which she did. Later, I call the Barnett's number.
She doesn't want to talk to you anymore.
When I get to the plant on Monday, Fran tells me Stacy has been looking for me since she arrived this morning. I have just settled in behind my desk when Stacy appears at the door.
Hi, can we talk?
Sure, come on in. She seems disturbed about something. She's avoiding my eyes as she sits down. Listen, about Friday night, I'm sorry about what happened when you dropped me off.
It's okay. Did your wife come back?
Well, no, she didn't. She's staying with her parents for a little while.
Was it just because of me?
Nah, we've been having some problems lately.
Al, I still feel kind of responsible. Look, why don't I talk to her?
Nah, you don't have to do that.
Really, I think I ought to talk to her. What's her number?
I finally admit to myself it might be worth a try, so I give the Barnett's number to Stacy. She writes it down and promises to call sometime today. Then she continues to sit there. Was there something else?
I'm afraid there is.
She pauses. So, what is it?
I don't think you're going to like this, but I'm pretty sure about it.
Stacy, what?
The bottlenecks have spread.
What do you mean the bottlenecks have spread? Is there a disease out there or something?
No, what I mean is we have a new bottleneck, or maybe even more than one. I'm not sure yet. Here, let me show you. Look at these computer printouts. These are listings of parts that are queued up at final assembly.
She goes over the lists with me. As always, the bottleneck parts are still in short supply. But lately, there have been shortages of some non-bottleneck parts as well.
Last week, we had a case in which we had to build an order for 200 DBD-50s. Out of 172 different parts, we were missing 17. Only one of them was a red tag part. The rest were green tags. The red part came out of heat treat on Thursday and was ready by Friday morning. But the others are still missing.
I leaned back in my chair and pinched the bridge of my nose. Damn it! What the hell is going on out there? I had assumed the parts that have to go through a bottleneck would reach assembly last. Is there a material shortage on those green tag parts? Some kind of vendor problem?
No, I haven't had any problems with purchasing. And none of the parts have any processing by outside contractors. The problem is definitely internal. That's why I really think we have one or more new bottlenecks. Maybe with the increase in throughput, we've loaded the plant to a level that we've run out of capacity on some other resources in addition to heat treat and the NCX-10.
Yes, that sounds like a possibility. With the bottlenecks more productive now, our throughput has gone up and our backlog is declining. But making the bottlenecks more productive has put more demand on the other work centers. If the demand on another work center has gone above 100%, then we've created a new bottleneck. Does this mean we're going to have to go through the whole process of finding the bottlenecks all over again? Just when it seemed like we were on our way out of this mess. Okay, look, I want you to find out everything you can, exactly which parts, how many, what products are affected, which routings they're on, how often they're missing, all that stuff. Meanwhile, I'm going to try to get hold of Jonah to see what he has to say about this. After Stacy leaves, and Fran does the calling to locate Jonah, I stand by the window in my office and stare at the lawn while I think. I took it as a good sign that inventory levels had declined after we implemented the new measures to make the bottlenecks more productive. A month ago, we were wading through parts on the non-bottleneck routings. There were piles and piles, and the piles kept growing. But some of the stocks have dwindled over the past couple of weeks of product assembly. Last week, for the first time since I've been at this plant, you could actually walk over to the assembly line without having to turn sideways to squeeze between the stacks and bins of inventory. I thought it was good. But now, this happens.
Mr. Rogo, I've got him on the line.
Jonah? Hi, listen, we've got trouble here.
What's wrong?
After I tell him the symptoms, Jonah asks what we've done since his visit, so I relate all the history to him, putting QC in front of the bottlenecks, training people to give special care to bottleneck parts, activating the three machines to supplement the NCX-10, the new lunch rules, assigning certain people to work only at the bottlenecks, increasing the batch sizes going into heat treat, implementing the new priority system in the plant.
New priority system?
Right. Then I explain about the red tags and green tags and how the system works.
Maybe I'd better come have another look.
I'm at home that night when the phone rings. Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
I owe you an apology. I'm sorry about what happened on Friday night. Stacy called me here. Al, I'm really embarrassed. I completely misunderstood.
Yeah, well, it seems to me there's a lot of misunderstanding between us lately.
All I can say is I'm sorry. I drove down thinking you'd be glad to see me.
I would have been if you'd stayed. In fact, if I'd known you were coming, I would have come home after work.
I know I should have called, but I was just in one of those moods.
I guess you shouldn't have waited for me.
I just kept thinking you'd be home any minute, and the whole time your mother kept giving me the evil eye. Finally, she and the kids went to bed, and about an hour later I fell asleep on the sofa and slept until you came in.
Well, you want to be friends again?
Yes, I would. When will I see you?
I suggest we try Friday all over again. She says she can't wait that long. We compromise on Wednesday.
Chapter 25.
Déjà vu. At the airport next morning, I again greet Jonah as he walks out of gate 2. By 10 o'clock, we're in the conference room at the plant. Sitting around the table are Lou, Bob, Ralph, and Stacy. Jonah paces in front of us.
Let's start with some basic questions. First of all, have you determined exactly which parts are giving you the problem?
Stacy, who's sitting at the table with a veritable fortress of paper around her and looking as if she's ready for a siege, holds up a list.
Yes, we've identified them. In fact, I spent last night tracking them down and double-checking the data with what's on the floor out there. Turns out the problem covers 30 parts.
Are you sure you released the materials for them?
Oh, yes. No problem there. They've been released according to schedule, but they're not reaching final assembly. They're stuck in front of our new bottleneck.
Wait a minute. How do you know it's really a bottleneck?
Well, since the parts are held up, I just figured it had to be
a bottleneck. Before we jump to conclusions, let's invest half an hour to go into the plant so we can find out what's happening.
So, we parade into the plant, and a few minutes later, we're standing in front of a group of milling machines. Off to one side are big stacks of inventory marked with green tags. Stacy stands there and points out the parts that are needed in final assembly. Most of the missing parts are right there and all bear green tags. Bob calls over the foreman, a hefty guy by the name of Jake, and introduces him to Jonah.
Yeah, all them parts been sitting here for about 2 or 3 weeks or more.
But we need them now. How come they're not being worked on?
You know which ones you want. We'll do them right now. But that goes against them rules you set up in that there priority system. You see over there? They all got red tags. We got to do all of them before we touch the stuff with the green tags. That's what you told us, right?
Uh-huh. It's becoming clear what's been happening.
You mean that while the materials with green tags have been building up, you've been spending all your time on the parts bound for the bottlenecks?
Yeah, well, most of it. Hey, like we only got so many hours in a day, you know what I mean?
How much of your work is on bottleneck parts?
Oh, maybe 75 or 80%. See, everything that goes to heat treater, the NCX-10, has to pass through here first. As long as the red parts keep coming, and they haven't let up one bit since that new system started, we just don't have the time to work on very many of the green tag parts.
There is a moment of silence. I look from the parts to the machines and back to Jake again.
What the hell do we do now? Do we switch tags? Make the missing parts red instead of green?
I guess the only solution is to expedite.
No, actually that is not the solution at all. Because if you resort to expediting now, you'll have to expedite all the time, and the situation will only get worse.
But what else can we do?
First, I want us to look at the bottlenecks because there is another aspect to the problem.
Before we can see the NCX-10, we see the inventory. It's stacked as high as the biggest forklift can reach. It's not just a mountain, but a mountain with many peaks. The piles here are even bigger than before we identified the machine as a bottleneck. And tied to every bin, hanging from every pallet of parts, is a red tag. Somewhere behind it all, its own hugeness obscured from our view, is the NCX-10.
How do we get there from here?
Here, let me show you.
And he leads us through the maze of materials, all work in process, until we reach the machine.
You know, I would guess just from looking at it that you have at least a month or more of work lined up here for this machine. And I bet if we were to heat treat, we would find the same situation. Tell me, do you know why you have such a huge pile of inventory here?
Because everyone ahead of this machine is giving first priority to red parts.
Yes, that's part of the reason. But why is so much inventory coming through the plant to get stuck here? Okay, I see I'm going to have to explain some of the basic relationships between bottlenecks and non-bottlenecks. By the way, do you remember when I told you that a plant in which everyone is working all the time is very inefficient? Now you see exactly what I was talking about.
Jonah walks over to the nearby QC station and takes a piece of chalk the inspectors use to mark defects on the parts they reject. He kneels down to the concrete floor and points to the NCX-10.
Here is your bottleneck. The X, whatever it is, machine. We'll simply call it X.
He writes an X on the floor. Then he gestures to the other machines back down the aisle.
And feeding parts to X are various non-bottleneck machines and workers. Because we designated the bottleneck as X, we'll refer to these non-bottlenecks as Y resources. Now, for the sake of simplicity, let's just consider one non-bottleneck in combination with one bottleneck.
With the chalk, he writes on the floor, Y, arrow, X. Product parts are what join the two in a relationship with each other, Jonah explains. and the arrow obviously indicates the flow of parts from one to the other. He adds that we can consider any non-bottleneck feeding parts to X, because no matter which one we choose, its inventory must be processed at some subsequent point in time by X.
By the definition of a non-bottleneck, we know that Y has extra capacity. Because of its extra capacity, we also know that Y will be faster in filling the demand than X. Let's say both X and Y have 600 hours a month available for production. Because it is a bottleneck, you will need all 600 hours of the X machine to meet demand. But let's say you need only 450 hours a month, or 75% of Y, to keep the flow equal to demand. What happens when Y has worked its 450 hours? Do you let it sit idle?
No, we'll find something else for it to do.
But Y has already satisfied market demand.
Well, then we let it get a head start on next month's work.
And if there is nothing for it to work on?
Then we'll have to release more materials.
And that is the problem. Because what happens to those extra hours of production from Y? Well, that inventory has to go somewhere. Y is faster than X, and by keeping Y active, the flow of parts to X must be greater than the flow of parts leaving X, which means...
He walks over to the work-in-process mountain and makes a sweeping gesture.
You end up with all this in front of the X machine. And when you're pushing in more material than the system can convert into throughput, what are you getting?
Excess inventory.
Exactly. But what about another combination? What happens when X is feeding parts to Y?
Jonah writes that on the floor with the chalk. X, arrow, Y.
How much of Y's 600 hours can be used productively here?
Only 450 hours again.
That's right. If Y is depending exclusively upon X to feed it inventory, the maximum number of hours it can work is determined by the output of X. And 600 hours from X equates to 450 hours for Y. After working those hours, Y will be starved for inventory to process, which, by the way, is quite accepted.
Wait a minute. We have bottlenecks feeding non-bottlenecks here in the plant. For instance, whatever leaves the NCX-10 will be processed by a non-bottleneck.
From other non-bottlenecks, you mean? And do you know what happens when you keep Y active that way? Look at these.
He draws a third diagram on the floor with the chalk. Y, arrow, A, and directly underneath, X, arrow, S. And underneath the S, the rest of the letters forming the word assembly. In this case, Jonah explains, some parts do not flow through a bottleneck. Their processing is done only by a non-bottleneck, and the flow is directly from Y to assembly. The other parts do flow through a bottleneck, and they are on the X route to assembly, where they are mated to the Y parts for a finished product. In a real situation, the Y route probably would consist of one non-bottleneck feeding another non-bottleneck, feeding yet another non-bottleneck, and so on to final assembly. The X route might have a series of non-bottlenecks feeding a bottleneck, which in turn feeds a chain of more non-bottlenecks. In our case, Jonah says, we've got a group of non-bottleneck machines downstream from X, which can process parts from either the X or the Y route.
But to keep it simple, I've diagrammed the combination with the fewest number of elements. One X and one Y. No matter how many non-bottlenecks are in the system, the result of activating Y just to keep it busy is the same. So let's say you keep both X and Y working continuously for every available hour. How efficient would the system be?
Super efficient.
No, you're wrong. Because what happens when all this inventory from Y reaches final assembly?
Well, we build the orders and ship them.
How can you? 80% of your products require at least one part from a bottleneck. What are you going to substitute for the bottleneck part that hasn't shown up yet?
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
So if we can't assemble, we get piles of inventory again. Only this time, the excess inventory doesn't accumulate in front of a bottleneck. It stacks up in front of final assembly.
Yeah, and another $1 million sits still just to keep the wheels turning.
You see, once more, the non-bottleneck does not determine throughput, even if it works 24 hours a day.
Okay, but what about that 20% of products without any bottleneck parts? We can still get high efficiencies with them.
You think so?
On the floor, he diagrams it like this. Y, arrow, product A, and directly underneath, X, arrow, product B. This time, the X and Y operate independently of one another. They are each filling separate marketing demands.
How much of Y's 600 hours can the system use here?
All of them.
Absolutely not. Sure, at first glance, it looks as if we can use 100% of Y, but think again.
We can only use as much as the market demand can absorb.
Correct. By definition, Y has excess capacity. So if you work Y to the maximum, you once again get excess inventory. And this time you end up not with excess work in process, but with excess finished goods. The constraint here is not in production. The constraint is marketing's ability to sell.
As he says this, I'm thinking to myself about the finished goods we've got crammed into warehouses. At least 2/3 of those inventories are products made entirely with non-bottleneck parts. By running non-bottlenecks for efficiency, we've built inventories far in excess of demand. And what about the remaining 1/3 of our finished goods? They have bottleneck parts, but most of those products have been sitting on the shelf now for a couple of years. They're obsolete. Out of 1,500 or so units in stock, we're lucky if we can sell 10 a month. Just about all of the competitive products with bottleneck parts are sold virtually as soon as they come out of final assembly. A few of them sit in the warehouse a day or two before they go to the customer, but due to the backlog, not many. I look at Jonah. To the 4 diagrams on the floor, he has now added numbers so that together they go, number 1, Y, arrow, X. Number 2, X, arrow, Y. Number 3, Y, arrow, A, and directly underneath, X, arrow, S, and directly underneath the S, the rest of the letters forming the word assembly. And number 4, Y, arrow, product A, and directly underneath, X, arrow, product B.
We've examined 4 linear combinations involving X and Y. Now, of course, we can create endless combinations of X and Y. But the 4 in front of us are fundamental enough that we don't have to go any further. Because if we use these like building blocks, we can represent any manufacturing situation. We don't have to look at trillions of combinations of X and Y to find what is universally true in all of them. We can generalize the truth simply by identifying what happens in each of these 4 cases. Can you tell me what you have noticed to be similar in all of them?
In no case does Y ever determine throughput for the system. Whenever it's possible to activate Y above the level of X, doing so results only in excess inventory, not in greater throughput.
Yes, and if we follow that thought to a logical conclusion, we can form a simple rule which will be true in every case. The level of utilization of a non-bottleneck is not determined by its own potential, but by some other constraint in the system.
He points to the NCX-10.
A major constraint here in your system is this machine. When you make a non-bottleneck do more work than this machine, you are not increasing productivity. On the contrary, you are doing exactly the opposite. You are creating excess inventory, which is against the goal.
But what are we supposed to do? If we don't keep our people working, we'll have idle time, and idle time will lower our efficiencies.
So what?
Beg pardon, but how the hell can you say that?
Just take a look behind you. Take a look at the monster you've made. It did not create itself. You have created this mountain of inventory with your own decisions. And why? Because of the wrong assumption that you must make the workers produce 100% of the time or else get rid of them to save money.
Well, granted that maybe 100% is unrealistic, we just ask for some acceptable percentage, say 90%.
Why is 90% acceptable? Why not 60% or 25%? The numbers are meaningless unless they are based upon the constraints of the system. With enough raw materials, you can keep one worker busy from now until retirement. But should you do it? Not if you want to make money.
What you're saying is that making an employee work and profiting from that work are two different things.
Yes, and that's a very close approximation of the second rule we can logically derive from the four combinations of X and Y we talked about. Putting it precisely, activating a resource and utilizing a resource are not synonymous.
In both rules, utilizing a resource means making use of the resource in a way that moves the system toward the goal. Activating a resource is like pressing the on switch of a machine. It runs whether or not there is any benefit to be derived from the work it's doing. So, really, activating a non-bottleneck to its maximum is an act of maximum stupidity.
And the implication of these rules is that we must not seek to optimize every resource in the system. A system of local optimums is not an optimum system at all. It is a very inefficient system.
Okay, but how does knowing this help us get the missing parts unstuck at the milling machines and move to final assembly?
Think about the buildup of inventory both here and at your milling machines in terms of these two rules which we just talked about.
I think I see the cause of the problem. We're releasing material faster than the bottlenecks can process it.
Yes, you are sending work onto the floor whenever non-bottlenecks are running out of work to do.
Granted, but the milling machines are a bottleneck.
No, they are not, as evidenced by all this excess inventory behind you. You see, the milling machines are not intrinsically a bottleneck. You have turned them into one. With an increase in throughput, it is possible to create new bottlenecks. But most plants have so much extra capacity that it takes an enormous increase in throughput before this happens. You only had a 20% increase. When I had talked to Alex by phone, I thought it unlikely a new bottleneck had occurred. What happened was that even as throughput increased, you continued loading the plant with inventory as if you expected to keep all your workers fully activated. This increased the load dumped upon the milling machines and pushed them beyond their capacity. The first priority red tag parts were processed, but the green tag parts piled up. So not only did you get excess inventory at the NCX-10 and at heat treat, but due to the volume of bottleneck parts, you clogged the flow of another work center and prevented non-bottleneck parts from reaching assembly.
All right. I see now the error of our ways. Can you tell us what we should do to correct the problem?
I want you all to think about it as we walk back to your conference room, and then we'll talk about what you should do. The solution is fairly simple.
Chapter 26.
Just how simple the solution is doesn't become apparent to me until I'm home that night. I'm sitting at the kitchen table with a pad of paper and a pencil, thinking about what was suggested today when Sharon comes in.
Hi.
Hi. What's up?
Not much. Just wondered what you were doing.
I'm working.
Can I help?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of technical. I think you'd probably be bored by it.
Oh, does that mean you want me to leave?
No, not if you want to stay. Do you want to try to solve a problem?
Okay.
All right. Let me think of how to put this to you. Do you know about the scout hike Dave and I were on?
She doesn't, but I do. Sharon doesn't know anything about the hike, but I can help you.
Son, I think there is a career for you in sales.
Yes, I do know about the hike. You weren't even there. I've heard everybody talk about it.
Okay, both of you can work on this. Here's the problem. We've got a line of kids on a hike in the woods. In the middle of the line, we've got Herbie. We've already taken the pack off Herbie's back to help him go faster, but he's still the slowest. Everybody wants to go faster than Herbie, But if that happens, the line will spread out and some of the kids will get lost. For one reason or another, we can't move Herbie from the middle of the line. Now, how do we keep the line from spreading? They both become thoughtful. All right. Now, both of you go into the other room. I'll give you 10 minutes, and then we'll see which one of you comes up with the best idea to keep everyone together in the line.
What does the winner get?
Well, anything within reason.
Anything?
Within reason. So they leave, and I get about 10 minutes of peace and quiet. Then I see the two faces looking around the corner. Ready? They come in and sit down at the kitchen table with me.
Want to hear my idea?
My idea's better.
It is not.
Okay, enough. What's your idea, Sharon?
A drummer.
Pardon me?
You know, like in a parade.
Oh, I know what you mean. There aren't any gaps in a parade. Everybody is marching in step. Sharon beams. Dave gives her a dirty look. So, everybody's marching in step to a beat. Sure, but how do you keep the people in front of Herbie from setting a faster pace?
You have Herbie beat the drum.
Yeah, that's not bad.
But my idea's better.
Okay, wise guy. What's your idea?
Tie ropes to everyone.
Ropes?
You know, like mountain climbers. You tie everyone together at the waist with one long rope. So that way, no one could get left behind, and nobody could speed up without everybody speeding up.
That's very good. It would mean that the line, which would translate to the total inventory in the plant, could never be longer than the rope. And the rope, of course, could be of a predetermined length, which means we could control it with precision. Everyone would have to walk at the same speed. I look at Dave, a little in awe of his creativity. Come to think of it, the rope makes it sound like having physical links between all the equipment, which is like an assembly line.
Yeah, an assembly line. Didn't you tell me once that the assembly line is supposed to be the best way to make things?
Well, yes, it's the most efficient way to manufacture. In fact, we use that approach when we do the final assembly for most of our products. The problem is that an assembly line won't work throughout the whole plant.
Oh.
But those are both good ideas you two thought up. In fact, if we changed each of your ideas just a little bit, we'd almost have the solution suggested to us today.
Like how?
See, to keep the line from spreading, it actually wouldn't be necessary to keep everyone marching to exactly the same step or to keep everyone tied to the rope. What we really have to do is just keep the kid at the front of the line from walking faster than Herbie. If we can do that, then everybody will stay together.
So we just have to tie the rope from Herbie to the kid at the front.
Or, maybe, Herbie and the boy at the front of the line will have signals. When the boy in the front goes too fast, Herbie tells him to wait or slow down.
That's right. Both of you figured it out.
So, what do we both win?
What do you want? A pizza with everything? A night at the movies? They're quiet for a moment.
The movie sounds good. But what I'd really like is if you could get Mom to come home again.
Now it gets very quiet.
But if you can't... We'll understand.
Well, I'm doing my best. Meanwhile, how about the movies? After the kids have gone to bed, I sit up wondering for the 100th time whether Julie will come back. Compared with my marital difficulties, the inventory problem at the plant seems simple. Or at least it seems simple now. I guess every problem is easy once you've figured it out. We are, in effect, going to do what my kids came up with. The Herbies... The bottlenecks are going to tell us when to let more inventory into the system, except we're going to use the aid of computers instead of drums and ropes. After we returned to the conference room in the office building today, we started talking, and we all agreed that we're obviously releasing too much material. We don't need 5 or 6 weeks of inventory in front of the bottleneck to keep it productive.
If we can withhold materials for red parts, instead of pushing them out there as soon as the first non-bottleneck has nothing to do, the milling machines will then have time to work on the green parts, and the parts we're missing will reach assembly with no problem.
That's right. What you have to do is find a way to release the material for the red parts according to the rate at which the bottlenecks need material, and strictly at that rate.
Fine, but how do we time each release of material so it arrives at the bottleneck when it's needed?
I'm not sure, but I see what you're worried about. We don't want the opposite problem of no work in front of the bottleneck.
Hell, we got at least a month before that happens, even if we release no more red tags from today on. But I know what you mean. If we idle a bottleneck, we lose throughput.
What we need is some kind of signal to link the bottlenecks with the release of material schedule.
Excuse me, this is just a thought. But maybe we can predict when to release material by some kind of system based on the data we've kept on both the bottlenecks.
What are you getting at?
Well, since we started keeping data on the bottlenecks, I've been noticing I'm able to predict several weeks in advance what each bottleneck will be working on at a particular time. See, as long as I know exactly what's in queue, I just take the average setup and process times for each type of part, and I'm able to calculate when each batch should clear the bottleneck. Because we're only dealing with one work center with much less dependency, we can average the statistical fluctuations and get a better degree of accuracy. Now, I know from observation it takes about 2 weeks, plus or minus a day or two, for material to reach the bottlenecks from the first operations. So by adding 2 weeks to the setup and process times of what's in queue at the bottleneck, I know how long it will take until the bottleneck is actually working on material we release. And as each batch leaves the bottleneck, we can update our information and calculate a date when Stacy should release more red tag material.
That's excellent.
Ralph, that's terrific. How accurate do you really think we can be with this?
I'd say we'd be accurate to within plus or minus a day. So if we keep, say, a 3-day stock of work in process in front of each bottleneck, we should be safe.
But in fact, Ralph, you can do much more than that with the same information.
Like what?
You can also attack the inventory problems in front of assembly.
You mean we not only can do something about excess inventory on the bottleneck parts, but on the non-bottleneck parts as well?
Exactly.
Sorry, folks. I'm not sure how I'd do that.
Now, if Ralph can determine a schedule for releasing red tag materials based on the bottlenecks, he can also determine a schedule for final assembly. Once he knows when the bottleneck parts will reach final assembly, he can calculate backwards and determine the release of the non-bottleneck materials along each of their routes. In this way, the bottlenecks will be determining the release of all the materials in the plant.
You know, that's going to produce the same effect as moving the bottlenecks to the head of production, which is what I'd intended for us to do.
Yeah, it sounds good. But I have to warn you, I can't say how long it'll take before I can make the computer do all that. I mean, I can have a schedule for the red tag materials worked out in fairly short order. The rest of it will take a while.
Oh, come on, Ralphie. Computer whiz like you ought to be able to crank that out in no time.
I can crank something out in no time, but I'm not going to promise it'll work.
Relax. As long as we ease the load on the milling machines, we'll be okay for the short haul. That'll give you the time to get something basic in place.
Hey, you may feel you have the time now to relax. I have to catch a plane for Chicago in 35 minutes.
Oh, shit. I guess we better move. It was not a graceful parting. Jonah and I ran out of the building, and I broke numerous speed limits without incident getting him to the airport.
I have, shall we say, a special interest in plants like yours. So I'd appreciate it if you'd keep me informed of what happened.
Sure, no problem. In fact, I'd planned on it.
Good. I'll be talking to you.
And with that, he was out of the car and with a wave was sprinting through the terminal doors. I didn't get a call, so I suppose he made it. When I go to work the next morning, we have a meeting about how to implement this approach. But before we can get down to talking about it, Bob Donovan starts waving a red flag at us.
You know, we could be walking into a big problem.
What's that?
What happens if efficiencies all over the plant go down?
Well, I think that's a risk we'll have to take.
Yeah. But it sounds like we're going to have a lot of people idle around here if we do this.
Yeah, we might have some people idle from time to time.
So are we just supposed to let everyone stand around out there?
Why not? Once somebody is already on the payroll, it doesn't cost us any more to have them be idle. Whether somebody produces parts or waits a few minutes doesn't increase our operating expense. But excess inventory? Now that ties up a lot of money.
Okay, but what about the reporting system? Seems to me that at the end of the month, when old Bill Peach is ready to decide if we stay open or if we close down, he's not going to be awful positive about us if he sees our efficiencies have taken a dive. I hear they do tend to frown upon that at headquarters.
He does have a point, Al.
All right, look. If we don't go ahead with a system to withhold inventory and release it according to the bottlenecks, we'll be missing a major opportunity to improve performance and save the plant. And I'm not about to stand by and let that happen just to maintain a standard that obviously has more impact on middle management politics than it does on the bottom line. I say we go ahead with this, and if efficiencies drop, let them. After those brave words, so reminiscent of Admiral Farragut in his Damn the Torpedo speech, the others are a little misty-eyed. And, Bob, if there is a lot of idle time out there, don't hassle anybody. Just make damn sure it doesn't show up in the efficiency reports next month, okay?
Gotcha, boss.